Welcome to MacGuffin Man. I'm Alex, and with me, as per usual, is James. Before we get started, you can check out our website, or while we're starting, or after the podcast, anytime. The world is your oyster. You can check out our website, MacGuffinMan.com. We have many, many podcasts for you to choose from. Our most recent podcasts were about Take Shelter and Midnight Special, a little Jeff Nichols twofer, The General after that, Buster Keaton movie from 1926, and LA Confidential after that. So we're going from Elroy to Elmore this week. This week's topic is Out of Sight. I also wrote something about the new Terrence Malick movie, Song to Song, that's on the website, and there will be something about The Lost City of Zed on there the day after this podcast posts. So read those if you like reading. Follow us on Twitter at The MacGuffin Men. Tell your friends, give us 5 stars on iTunes, and theme song.
Welcome to the MacGuffin Men. And now, here are Alex and James.
James.
Yep.
What are we talking about here today?
The fact that a bunch of Americans have to say Zed now because of that movie. No.
Well, like in the lead up to that movie coming out, I was just constantly thinking about it in my head as The Lost City of Z, because it's an American movie, and then, you know, sort of put the pieces together. Oh yeah, doesn't take place in America, so I enjoyed that.
Yeah. Anyway. No, we are talking about Out of Sight.
Yes.
A Steve Soderbergh film.
Yeah.
From 1998.
Yep.
And as you said, based on a Elmore Leonard novel.
Exactly. Who is not the same person as Elroy, James Elroy.
Correct.
Yeah. Elmore Leonard seems way easier to get along with, judging by research that you told me about James Elroy last week.
Yeah. Not that he's, I don't know him to be a particularly easygoing person, but relatively speaking, yes.
Yeah, I saw him interviewed, and I can already tell that he would get along better with me than Mr. Elroy. But that's not what we're here to talk about today, picking out which author we would like to chat with more.
No, but it's worth mentioning that Elmore Leonard has had a lot of his work turned into films. And
yeah.
Scott Frank, the guy who did the screenplay for this, also adapted Get Shorty, which was another Elmore Leonard novel.
Yes, yeah, exactly. And Rum Punch famously was turned into Jackie Brown by Quentin Tarantino around the same time. And then, like, there are a lot of other Elmore Leonard stories that have been adapted, like The Big Bounce with Owen Wilson, which nobody saw and was apparently terrible, but that's an Elmore Leonard novel, you know? Like,
yep.
It's just he writes movies that are pretty easy to turn into good or entertaining movies, you know, at least the ones that don't involve Owen Wilson, I guess. But
yeah, it seems that way.
Yeah.
There's your first Jackie Brown mention, maybe not the last.
Almost certainly not the last, because knowing you, Michael Keaton will be a topic of conversation
on any movie.
Yeah, exactly. You talked about him way too much on the podcast for The General. It was very bizarre.
So where do you want to start with this? I mean, I feel it's your boy Soderbergh. We've already talked about my boy Michael Keaton.
Yeah, and George Clooney's kind of my boy too.
George Clooney is kind of your boy.
Not to mention my undying love for Don Cheadle. Ving Rhames is fantastic. The cast in this movie is just top to bottom great.
Yeah, well, this was your birthday choice, so I'll let you take the lead on wherever you want to go with this one.
I don't know. Like, I just have such a deep love for this movie and always have. And, like, I mean, I probably saw it for the first time when I was 16, shortly after Traffic came out. And I do have, like, a distinct memory of when I was watching it with a friend, and when Buddy's introductory scene where he's trying to steal a car, and then the woman with the groceries is trying to load groceries into her trunk, and then just says he doesn't need a tip, he'll just take your car. Like, when that happened, I was like, this is just the perfect movie for me, because, like, it's taking sort of like a scene that you would see. Obviously, I wasn't thinking about this at the time. I was just laughing because that line's wonderful, and Ving Rhames' performance is fantastic. But when you look at that scene, you sort of see it as this. It's a scene that is in so many crime movies. Somebody needs a car for some illegal activity, so they steal a car that can't be traced back to them. But this isn't just the same sort of carthievery that happens. It's something that also involves talking with a person. It involves a mild racist maybe being shown up. There's something about like that woman that just seems, maybe it's just that she's old, she seems like she might be kind of racist. And just like a very good button line on the scene. And it's just fantastic. And the scene lasts like 25 seconds probably. And it perfectly sets up that character because he does nothing. You know, Buddy and Jack are both sort of gentleman thieves. They're nonviolent people. Jack talks about in the movie how, you know, the we see him shoot a gun for the first time towards the end of this movie. And, you know, that just sort of gentleman thief aspect that runs all throughout this movie that makes it so, so entertaining and is able to give you a little bit of a twist on a type of movie that was rampant throughout the 90s, the crime movie, not just the Elmore Leonard crime movie, but the crime movie in general. And it does that thing that Steven Soderbergh does so often where he just makes a genre picture and somehow finds the one way that nobody has thought to do this, you know? Yeah. Just sort of like how, I mean, so frequently it feels like shots that he sets up over the course of his career, maybe less so in this movie, but there are some notable examples where it's just like he thinks about, okay, this is how people would shoot it, so I'm going to do the exact opposite of it, you know?
Yeah.
And that sort of inversion is what made me fall in love with this movie and what has continued a strong 15 plus year love of it. Yeah.
Yeah. I didn't see this movie right when it came out. But I have weirdly clear memories of the commercials and the trailers. And that line is obviously in it because it is a funny line and involves nothing bad that you couldn't air on television.
Yeah, exactly.
And same with, I didn't steal this car. I stole it a week ago. Which is another really funny line from this movie. I remember those really clearly, but you're right. It is those two moments, or I mean, more so the Ving Rhames moment is so, it's just so emblematic of this whole movie. Like, you can sum so much of this movie up in that moment. You know, it's not about the crime, it's about the criminal. You know, this is a crime movie, but as far as action scenes and violence go, there's not a ton of it. I mean, there is some gross violence and some gore and stuff like that, but for a movie of its length, it's not as though there's a ton of it. And yeah, it's part of that gentleman thief thing. It's more the criminals than the crime. It's watching someone do it smoothly instead of the way that is the most obviously entertaining spectacle kind of way. You know, it's not so many car chases or, you know, like a carjacking. It's I guess it is a carjacking, yeah. But it's the most polite one that speaks to their personalities instead of what a, you know, 16 to 35 or 16 to 25 year old male wants to go see when they're in the theater.
Yeah, exactly. And it also, like, that scene even feels like Buddy might shake her hand before, like, he walks away and drives away with her car. You know, like, there's just such a feeling of niceness to both Jack and Buddy all throughout this movie. That just sort of, yeah, it's just wonderful, you know?
Yeah, it is funny and it is clever, but it's, as you said, it's just a different way to do it that is still extremely entertaining and funny and character-based and quirky, but not the most direct way to do something. And it's great.
Yeah, exactly. And even, I mean, the most violent part of this movie, you know, we don't see it. It's when I forget the name of the character, but when Steve Zahn has to go murder
Glenn.
Glenn. When Glenn has to go murder the character that owes Maurice Snoopy money, we don't really see anything. We see a shot of Steve Zahn's face, Glenn's face, two bullet flashes and the sound. And then basically we get a cut to Snoopy basically painting over what's probably a window with spray paint, with red spray paint, as White Boy Bob chops the person up in the background, you know? So that's the most grotesquely violent thing in this movie. And after that, is it Nice Guy Eddie? It might be Nice Guy Eddie as that character's name, something like that. And, you know, we get a shot of that corpse very briefly with Paul Calderon in a later scene. But, you know, the violence is just covered up. And when we get violence at other points of this movie, it's very quick and nothing really lingers. You know, like you get some some actual aftermath that has to be dealt with, like bloody guns being taken out of Isaiah Washington and White Boy Bob's hands, you know, in the climax.
And White Boy Bob shooting himself in the head by accident.
Yeah, no, absolutely. But even, and you do, it's more the wreckage of the violence that the movie focuses on than the actual violence, because even that White Boy Bob shooting himself in the head, that happens so quickly, and then it's just done. We're just done with this, you know? Like, there's no, like, prolonged shot of White Boy Bob's head to show you what happened. You see it when Snoopy goes for the gun. You see it pretty clearly, but it never really feels like the violence is the focus. It's like you said, it's the character that's the focus. And in the Glenn scene, when Glenn has to murder somebody, it's about Glenn dealing with having murdered somebody more than it's about the murder. Yeah.
Oh, absolutely. It's we think about the gun violence in this movie. There's White Boy Bob shooting himself, which is gross but played for laughs.
Yep. And is funny.
Yeah.
And I should point out, I think that happens in Intolerable Cruelty, which is a movie starring George Clooney, and I'm so close to certain that it's the same guy, like White Boy Bob. Something very similar happens. I saw that movie when it was in theaters at like 6 a.m. at the end of a movie marathon, and I hated it. So I've never verified this, but I'm so confident that this is correct. Anyway, continue.
Yeah, and then, as you said, the scene with Glenn is, it's not about let's have a shootout scene, let's not have a cool robbery scene or a cool vengeance moment. It's about the awful dread that he experiences before, after, and during this murder that he has to deal with. And up until then, Glenn's been this really goofy character, and, you know, for good reason. He is just kind of a dumb guy. But things get very real there. And again, it's not a cool, fun action scene. It's all the worst parts about violence. You know, it's what it does to people kind of forced into this position. And the gunfight at the end between Snoopy and your boy George Clooney.
Jack Foley.
Jack. No, I know. Yeah. It's more fun. It's more of it's played for laughs. We kind of learn more about them. We learn that Jack isn't really prone to violence, doesn't have a lot of experience with it. We understand that Maurice does, and it's, you know, it's near the end of the movie, so we know who these people are, but we're still building this characterization of them.
Yeah, absolutely.
So,
it's a fantastic movie. And speaking of George Clooney, I think George Clooney is awesome in this movie. I know I am a bigger fan of George Clooney than you are. I suppose I'm a bigger fan of George Clooney than most people are, but like, this movie is absolutely like so almost uniquely plays to his strengths, you know. It's also like the proto Danny Ocean character, which is the other character where you just find him in his element. But I feel like this even more so, because this feels more like a movie than any of the Ocean's movies do. The Ocean's movies more feel like rich people stretching their legs and doing it in a fabulous way, but that's just how it feels. But this movie, I feel like the lines that Clooney walks throughout this movie when he's playing Jack Foley, I love, you know, I love seeing characters or actors playing characters a little dumber than they actually are. like, there are some good moments where Jack sort of slips into, especially in the trunk scene with him and Karen, when they're talking about movies, George Clooney say misquoting Network is like top five Clooney moment, you know.
I'm as bad as Talon, I'm not gonna take any more of your shit.
It's so good, and the way he quotes it, and like, and also when he's when Karen says, "You fashion yourself a real Clyde Barrow," right? The look on his face as he's being like, "Who is Clyde Barrow? Who is Clyde Barrow?" That's so true to life to somebody that can't quite remember, like, knows that this person is referencing something, wants to be in on this conversation.
Yeah. Trying to look sly.
Exactly. It's just so great. And the way that this movie in general navigates the total, you know, the owning of the room that George Clooney is so good at doing in so many movies, but also navigates the way that is just like, it's just not a truth. Like, it's not something that can ever really exist. Everybody is human, and everybody has their various foibles and gets caught up on certain things, you know? Like, when George Clooney, or when Jack Foley's robbing a bank, very in control. And that's our intro to the character. So I think that sort of even paints over some of the more, you know, less smooth moments of Jack's character. But, you know, like, when he's in a... when he's in a bank, he's in control. But in aspects involving real life, there are still things where it's just like he can never be the true Cary Grant style charmer, because that type of person doesn't exist. He can get pretty close, and in some situations where he's robbed like 200 banks, so he knows how to do this well. He's very confident about it. Maybe he hasn't started a car 200 times, so that's been a problem. But like. It's just great that the way this movie navigates somebody that is able to control a seemingly way more stressful scenario than just talking to a woman. And then when he's in the bar with Karen later in the movie, there's a moment where he really just gets turned on his head, and he plays it really well. Yeah,
and even just his character of the gentleman thief. I mean, it's so cool and smooth and suave. And it works out so well when you're in a room full of ladies and other gentlemen. Mm-hmm. But we see when he is around hardened criminals, when he's around Snoopy, when things are really getting intense, there's downfalls to that. You know, being this nice guy who's never had to resort to weapons means you don't know how to use a weapon. It's,
yeah.
it's all these ups and downs that it's a character that we're used to seeing always in the up, and now we put him into a different position, and all these downs are coming at him in a very serious way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for sure. So I think the something about this movie, because you know, I said off the top, I've loved this movie very much for a long time, and I've seen it a number of times. This is the first time I ever like watched this movie while thinking about it, so it's like a totally different experience, because I always just assumed it was kind of like a lark of a movie that I really loved. And I was kind of expecting to not find a lot. Apologies to Mr. Soderbergh, who I should never ever count out. But you know, but I don't know. I just found a lot in this movie that I really liked, and I thought we've touched on it a little bit without clearly discussing just the way that this movie. There's a lot
Michael
of
Keaton.
Michael Keaton. Yes, Michael Keaton is in this film. No, there's a lot of like two sides to the coin, and sort of fire and ice type of thing throughout this movie, right? Like the easiest way to point to it is Karen and Jack, right? Lawwoman and gentleman thief. You know, they're just the exact opposite sides of things, not necessarily as people, but like on the spectrum of lawful people, they are, you know, not on the same side of things, you know?
Career criminal versus career law enforcement.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, the comparison to the way Miami is shot and the way Detroit is shot. You know, you're in Miami and everything is warm and reddish. You get to Detroit, it is all gunmetal blue, you know? And even in a smaller level, you've got just between the criminals throughout this movie. You've got Jack and Snoopy, who we've talked about. Jack is the nonviolent criminal, preferably. He gets violent by the end. And then Snoopy is the very violent criminal, who is like so violent he's also a boxer. You know what I mean? And then even just between Jack and Richard, you know, you've got similar. They're both... I don't remember why Richard is in prison. Do you?
Isn't it the bank that he robs and tells his sister about beforehand? And
no, so Richard, Albert Brooks.
Oh, maybe they don't even say. I always just assume some kind of insider trading.
That's exactly what I'm assuming too, right? But so there's
some kind of white collar crime.
Exactly. They're in for theft of some capacity, but it's just totally different kinds of theft, you know? George Clooney's or Jack's in for the type of theft you do after you throw your tie, whereas Dick is in for the theft you do while still wearing a tie, you know?
Yeah.
But they're still different sides of the same coin. And I just find the way that operates throughout the movie really interesting. And even in the sidekicks, Buddy and Isaiah Washington are, you know, sidekicks that also have different stances on violence and gentlemanship, you know?
Yes.
And that, Mr. Ving Rhames is a gentleman and Isaiah Washington's character is a rapist, you know?
Yeah, and one of them is very remorseful and at times pre-morseful.
Yes.
And one seems like you just never see a moment of hesitation or regret from Isaiah Washington.
Yeah, exactly. Who, again, I mean, I don't know, something that is very clear in this movie and most of Steven Soderbergh's movies is that he can find ensemble casts really, really well. Like I pointed out to you in an email. I mean, I didn't have to point it out to you. It's obvious that Viola Davis is in this movie. Soderbergh was very early on the Viola Davis train. And Isaiah Washington, whose career was derailed for, I think, very legitimate reasons, his blatant homophobia on the set of Grey's Anatomy, famously. But I think he's a very talented character actor. So that he's in this movie doesn't hurt the movie, you know, because he's quite good in it.
Right.
Yeah. Like the worst performance in this movie is Jennifer Lopez, who is still pretty good. You know?
Yeah. I think that's still one of the things that doesn't quite ring true for me is the romance element, which is so essential to this movie.
Yeah.
That's a big part of where this movie loses me.
Yeah, no, I get that. I think the, 'cause the thing that you have to believe, to sort of follow that stuff, I think the scene of them in the trunk and the bar, both of those scenes are amazing. And I could watch them, especially the bar scene, I intercut with the scene in her hotel room. I could watch that like on a loop for an hour probably, and it would be wonderful. Yeah. I just think the way it's done is so, so beautiful. I do need to see the ad agency guys in it at the beginning though. That is a part that I refuse to lose, but that's part of the setup, so I think it's necessary. But I think
so
the
gross.
Yeah, I know, it really is. I love the waitress, her laughing when she says I'd rather pay for my own drink. Like, that's amazing. You know, that's clearly a woman that has been in the same situation. It's just like good work. This is your proper reaction.
Been in it and working at a nicer bar, having seen maybe not these guys, but these guys.
Yeah, so no, absolutely.
Their working career, right?
They're from the Apple, flew in, pitching a client, Hiram Walker. Anyway, I honestly totally lost my train of thought. Oh, the trunk scene. So, scene that I love, find it very entertaining. Three different Faye Dunaway movies are referenced in a 1998 film. Going after my heart. But the thing you have to believe for the rest of the movie to work is that those two people fell in love in that period of time, which is just something I do not believe to be possible. Also, in the timing of the movie, I would imagine that scene is supposed to take place over more time than what we actually see. But it's still not long enough for Jack to go through all the things he goes through. You know, and I just sort of assumed that Soderbergh's take on this was that they weren't in love. He just sort of was just following her on a lark, and they both wanted to be together in some capacity, but it was mostly lust based. And he talks about like them in the bar, and he's like he says that, I forget what interview I was watching where he said this, and he's like, Jack's in love with her, and I'm just like, that doesn't seem right, Mr. Soderbergh. So I don't know. I've always sort of watched the movie as they just both don't quite know what they wanted of life, and this just seems like an option because it's the exact opposite of what they have, and that they're not necessarily in love with each other. They're just in love with the idea of being the exact opposite type of person that they are currently.
Yeah, that is more down the path that I see this making any sense.
Yeah, exactly. It's the only way it makes sense.
Yeah, maybe not even complete opposite, just I don't see them falling in love in that amount of time. But I do think they play some of just the curiosity of it well, you know, to hit it off that it's because they're forced into such an intimate position, right? It just kind of puts everything in fast forward, and things work out well in this pressure cooker romance situation, mm-hmm. of criminal speed dating, but I do like that part about just their curiosity with each other and finding something that works. And it's such a unique situation that you know, it's two people who are obviously physically attracted to each other, who get along really well, and you just imagine that Jack has spent so much of his life, you know, using people quickly, just figuring someone out, becoming whoever they want him to be, and playing into that for his own gain. Mm-hmm. And I would imagine that that's there's an element to that to every, you know, person who lives in, who works in law enforcement as well, just mm-hmm. to get the information you need, get the help you need, get the whatever it is you need from everybody.
I mean, we see it in the way that she plays Glenn multiple times throughout the movie, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. So I think that this is one where they're both kind of ready to get right into that gear, but Jack doesn't really have to win anything over. You know, there's a time where he doesn't want to get shot by her, which is, you know, obviously counter to that. But I think it's a time for these people who are both charismatic.
You mean where he does want to get shot by her, right?
No, like when she's got the gun in the trunk and he's...
Oh, yes. Okay.
He's outside of the trunk.
Okay.
There's just this... I think the first reaction is to be whoever the other person wants them to be, and then they realize that they don't really have anything to gain in that moment. She's not getting out of there anytime quickly. He doesn't really need to convince her of anything, and I think they kind of act like themselves for the first time and realize that the other one likes it, and that part makes sense to me.
Yes, I agree. And that's the first time we see the real veneer of Jack Foley come off too, right?
Right.
It's that Clyde Barrow moment that I was talking about, where it's just like he's used to being in control of the situation. Even when he's in prison, he's sort of like watching things from afar and able to use somebody else's prison escape as his own escape and do it better, you know? So
got a real Andy Dufresne vibe.
How dare you bring that up in relation to this movie? This is a good movie about breaking out of prison as opposed to a piece of shit overrated movie about breaking out of prison. Am I making you laugh until you cough and die? Is that what's happening?
I just have a cough right now.
Okay, all right, fair enough. Don't die on the podcast, please.
I think the ratings.
The ratings. We might get two listeners. They might both be cops. So, even in prison, he's controlling in a way that he is able to use this prison escape better than the people that actually came up with the idea. And then he goes right into this trunk with this woman, and he's, you know, got his hand on her hip in a weirdly possessive moment, and just sort of assumes he'll be in control of this situation too. And then she sort of gets to a point where he gets slowly put off guard, because he realizes he's not in control of this situation. They are together locked in a trunk and they are having a conversation, and he can't keep up with her and can't control her the way that this conversation is going to go, the way that she can with Loretta, who is the bank teller at the beginning of the movie, you know, who's, he just terrifies into, you know, being controlling of her.
Yeah.
Cause Karen's just not afraid of him.
Right.
Yeah.
And speaking of control, we've touched on the ensemble cast, but I love saving the credits for the end and hitting us with so many great cameos and ensemble cast members as well.
Yeah, absolutely. You mean not seeing that Michael Keaton is in this movie before Michael Keaton walks in, sort of thing?
Yeah, and I totally forgot that Samuel Jackson shows up in this movie.
Yeah.
In a fantastic little, extremely short cameo.
Yeah, it's great. I think the only reasoning I've ever gotten behind Samuel Jackson being in this movie is that he just wanted to work with Steven Soderbergh, which seems like a weird reasoning in 1998. But
yeah.
I mean, I respect the cinephile in you, Mr. Samuel L. Jackson. You know, like, that's great. If he was in that early, good for him. I wasn't.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, kind of you are. You just didn't know it.
I mean, this is my real gateway drug to Soderbergh. I think Traffic led me to this, and then this is where it really began.
Right on.
Yeah.
So speaking of that van scene as well, and Karen giving Jack back his Zippo lighter.
Yeah.
What are we meant to take from that moment and just the symbol of this lighter throughout the whole movie? Because we don't see a ton of it, but it kind of bookends the movie.
Yeah, absolutely. I am going to give you the Soderbergh is a god filmmaker reasoning that I have, and then I'm going to give you the real reason. So it's like what we talked about, what he sees in Karen is the exact opposite of his life, right? I think this movie, I mean, it's pretty explicitly about the road not taken, and I think that is the thing in this movie that I think has kept me thinking, like wanting to come back to it, even without realizing why, over the years, is that this movie is just so consistently about two characters thinking you know, Jack vocalizes it more, but Karen's thinking it as well, clearly, just in, by engaging with Jack. These people thinking, am I stuck in this life that I've chosen for myself? Am I a bank robber for the rest of my life? Am I just going to continue on this this carousel of robbing banks and going to jail, robbing banks and going to jail? Am I going to continue on this law enforcement carousel? You know, and she's also not happy in her career. You know, she gets talked down to by people that are higher up than her, and despite the fact that she's clearly good at her job, you know what I mean?
Yeah, and her fortune kind of seems predestined by her father, who we haven't mentioned, the great Dennis Farina.
The great Dennis Farina. He's so good in everything. Everybody knows this. But yeah, the how they are both reconsidering their life. And I mean, Clooney's on the later side of 30s when he's making this movie as well. And so that, just like looking at him, his age sort of helps with that, just as he's approaching middle age. It's like, is this what my life is going to be? You know, it just sort of fits in with the timeline. And I think that's something that's really interesting about this movie, is that that constant wondering that a human will do once you get to a certain point of life, like, is this it? Like, is this all I have to do? Like, could I dramatically change my career if I wanted to? And I think it's something you can even see in Soderbergh's career. I mean, we joked a little bit about it before the podcast, his decision to temporarily retire, and his idea was that he was not going to make movies anymore. He was going to focus on painting, you know, and he came back to filmmaking, you know, and it's just sort of, maybe he found a way to be happy making films. Maybe the Nick really didn't reinvigorate his filmmaking ideas. But you know,
and this is also his get out of just doing art house movies.
Yeah, no, exactly.
Film too, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, so he, but yeah, like he did try to move away from the thing that he did for decades, and then came back to it. And like you're saying, he has called this movie his escape from the art house ghetto, because he was at a time where he was coming off of, you know, after Sex, Lies, and Videotape, he makes King of the Hill, Kafka, The Underneath, and Schizopolis, none of which made money. Schizopolis, I believe, topped out at $10,000. But I mean, that movie was a curiosity more than anything anyway. But, and this was a movie that he felt like he kind of needed to make in order to make sure he would still have a career, you know, but also a movie that he could make in a style that was different from what people expected of him. So he was still doing the same job, but he was able to sort of reinvigorate his style, I guess, you know. But what I'm saying with the lighter, to get back to that, is Jack is flicking.
Wait, can I just interject one thing that I only just came up with now when you were talking?
I love it. Hot takes.
The hottest of takes. And a chance to mention our girl, Catherine Keener.
Fantastic.
as Adele.
Great pants. Continue. Or tights, I guess.
True. But to speak of, you know, being put in a box and...
yeah.
Well, and going two different ways, right? Yep. She reveals that's how that box, the sawing a woman in a box magic trick is done. Mm-hmm. You know, you get put actually in just one box, and then there's this split, and there's the box you stay in, there's the one that you were never in, there's the road not taken, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, even looking at Adele and Jack's relationship, like they were married and then they became divorced. And you look at Adele when she talks to him and Jack in her very brief times, conversing with him on the phone, you know, she's joking like, hey, don't get shot when you escape from prison, like stuff like that, like taking very serious things not seriously at all. And that's the type of thing that that Jack tried to move away from, but also he still calls his ex-wife, you know what I mean? So he's not totally removed from, he's not totally divorced from this woman he divorced, you know. And the same could be said of her. But yeah, getting back to the lighter, like he's just sort of flicking something on and off. And I mean, it helps that it's a flame because of the fire and ice thing that I was pointing out earlier. But it's just him standing absentmindedly and turning something on and off, you know? And that's just sort of what he is doing constantly in this movie. He's waffling back and forth between, am I this person or am I, can I be this other person that that I would like to be, but don't know that I have the capacity to be, right?
And looking cool doing it the whole time.
Looking so cool. So that's my like film theory reading of it. The true story is George Clooney and Steven Soderbergh were having dinner at George Clooney's house in the pre-production of this movie, when they're bouncing around ideas, Steven Soderbergh just saw George Clooney doing that and called Scott Frank and said, "Hey, there's this cool thing that George Clooney can do with a lighter. I think it'll help Jack." That's the story, you know. So I think it works, and I think they put it in the movie at times that are calculated in a way that makes me think that they developed a meaning around it, like that he's doing it right in the beginning in the opening bank. Bank heist, you know, like that he's doing it right then while he is staring at a man with a briefcase that's being asked about loan apps, you know, like he is looking at this man. He's like, "No, I can't do this." And as we learned later in the movie, he threw his tie because he realized he couldn't even get anywhere near that level of the, you know, normal human existence. And so he's flicking this thing on and off. Can I do this? Can I do this? No, I'm going to go rob a bank. You know, so I think the meaning that I have injected into it, I think it's there in the movie. And that Karen hands it back to him at the end of the movie is sort of like, yep, this keeps going. You keep the lighter for a little bit because you are going to keep flicking things on and off, you know?
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. So that's my reading of the lighter.
Okay.
Yeah.
I think that fits.
It does. And like when you watch it in the movie, if you do keep a close eye on when it actually happens, it does always happen in situations where, I mean, that's pretty much the whole movie when he's doing this, but where he is sort of oscillating between what he wants to be, you know, it's his introduction to the scene in the hotel bar with Karen as well. Right.
It's just yeah,
like, that which is the most explicit version of him trying to be something that he's not. You know, they actually play a game where they are Gary and Celeste,
which is odd name choice. But
hey, man, Gary and Celeste forever.
Sure. Yeah. No, I think my reading of it is similar. I hadn't quite thought about it in those terms, but it just to me it represents, you know, just the coolest version of him that exists, you know, the him using that lighter at the times he does, and you know, not just using it, but to flick it on in that way, you know, just to do it in this really suave kind of sly way, I think is very important. And he has it at times and he doesn't have it at times, and he, as you said, he kind of makes a push to be this person when he can, and sometimes he fails. You know, he wants to be, you know, as we said, this gentleman thief, this guy who's always smooth, who gets away with everything, but it doesn't always work out, and he gets in the gunfights with Snoopy, and this person that he is trying to be and trying to skate by on is not going to fit him in every situation. And I think he feels he's pulled something off when he's with Karen and things are going well, but it's a facade and it's not really who he is. And even the guy that he is when he has the lighter and he's this ultra smooth guy too, I mean, that's a facade as well. Mm-hmm. And I think he's stuck in between these two things that he can never fully really dive into 100%. And that's why I think that's why Karen gives him the lighter at the end. She wants him to have that happiness. I think they genuinely do care about each other deeply and they want to make each other happy. And this is his last moment, you know, before he's in jail to have any of that kind of experience. You know, he's in a prison van, so it's not exactly glamorous. Mm-hmm. But she's giving him this token, you know, this icon of him being out on the run, robbing these banks smoothly, getting away with everything and looking good doing it. And you know, she gives it to him for a small time, but then says, "I'm going to have to take it away as soon as the riot's over." You know, this thing that you have, I want to provide that for you, but it can't last forever. And I think that's, you know, that's exactly what we see at the end of that shootout. She wants him to be happy. She cares about him. But when push comes to shove, she's not just going to let him walk all over her. She still has this identity of who she is, and she's going to, you know, stick to who she is. And I, you know, I think that's a smart choice for her, the way that most people should go with things. And, you know, there's just that veneer, that way to look cool, but doesn't really apply in the long run. And I think that's the idea that she grapples with, and again, wants him to be happy, but knows that she can't let that last forever.
Yeah, exactly. So I guess that leads into a question I had for you. Is there any character development in this movie? Besides characters that were once alive being dead now, you know?
Like that goldfish. I'd say there's character development for Glenn. The notable loss of his glasses, he's another connection to LA Confidential. he sees the world for what it is. I think he's been an accomplice to a lot of crimes, and I think he sees what he does as a victimless crime because he doesn't see the victims. He robs people's houses when they aren't home. Yeah. He moves criminals around from location to location, but not at their crime. And I think he is kind of happy to. It's a total bliss is ignorance thing. When she asks him to remove his glasses, he says, "No, I see better with these things on." And it's at nighttime. You know, it's so clearly not true. Mm-hmm. But he sees the world the way he wants to see it, which is a world where he's just kind of an innocent goofball who is getting money for things that he's not going to ask too many details about. So I think Glenn learned something. I think he learns a pretty hard lesson, but I think it's overall a lesson that anyone in that lifestyle who thinks they're not hurting anybody should learn at some point. I think Jack's arc is one of him almost learning something and not, or him almost changing and realize that he can't, maybe put more accurately. Mm-hmm. And I think, I think Karen struggles. As I said, you know, she kind of comes to a brink of going the other way with it and putting romance and physical attraction over her ideals as someone who respects the law and is good at her job and won't let that slide. And it's unfortunate because she's not asking for much more than I think anyone should deserve. I think she just found it in the wrong person. And she doesn't have an arc either. I think she just kind of the same thing as Jack maybe, but she just sort of wavers and then doubles down on who she is. And she's a good person who's good at her job, so it's not a bad thing to double down on the way that it might be for Jack Foley.
Yeah, I kind of feel the same way. Like for the stuff about Glenn, like that's a really good point that I hadn't thought about. I've mostly been focusing on Jack and Karen. But yeah, I sort of feel like that there just isn't a ton of character development with them, which is something I really like about this movie. In that, you know, like times change and people change, but you're still could be like flicking this lighter on and off, wondering if you can do something else with your life, you know. And I think that explains why I still love this movie 15 years later. I could love it in a different way because now I'm thinking about it a little bit, but I do keep coming back to it. I really enjoy that aspect of it in that nobody really changes. It's just like things happen and then your crises continue until you're like, well, I guess this is how it works, you know. This is life continuing on, you know. Maybe I'll have another crisis like this in 10 years, we'll see.
Yeah, I think there are well-rounded characters, and I think there's moments of, very almost existential character questions that they have to answer, Karen mostly. But I don't think there's an arc. But I mean, it's still an interesting line if it's not an arc, I guess. And it's not just a straight line. It's more jagged than that. But
oh yeah, for sure.
Let's just say it's a character circle because I think everyone's back to where they started other than Glenn.
yeah, pretty much. I mean, we've got to talk about the freeze frames.
Yeah, I almost didn't want to bring it up because I think this is a classic Alex likes everything else, so he's going to love something he would normally hate because you typically hate freeze frames, but I know you're going to love them because this is a movie that you love.
Yeah. Oh yeah, for sure. And I mean, they're used for different moments. Like Soderbergh, listening to him on the commentary, he talks about, you know, the title card. Like he always wanted, that was the only freeze frame he had planned, was that when Jack throws his tie, it's freeze frame, title of the movie. Everything else was just sort of decided on by feeling in the editing room. And you know, I hate freeze frames. Usually I hate them as freeze frame endings, because that's when freeze frames are most often used. And it's also just an unbelievably stupid thing to introduce as the last moment of your movie. It's just, it's a new addition to your style that hasn't been seen before in the preceding 2 hours and 2 minutes or whatever, and now you're just gonna throw that at me, and then that's my goodbye. It's just it's idiotic. But like the way that they're used in this movie, I enjoy in that it's kind of like, you know, they're like frozen moments, and so much of this movie is about there's so much time shifting in this movie, jumping from place to place, and the thing that I realized about it that sort of made me realize why I never had a problem with it is when they're used for the last time. They're used for the last time in the hotel room scene, and so that's when we're like pretty much we're caught up with the time of the movie. Like we've had all our flashbacks, we are here, and these freeze frames are still happening. These are still frozen moments, but the last one that we have is during that love scene, right? Because that's when Jack and Karen get to where they think they want to be. They're with the exact opposite of who they are, and they're just happy, and it's just beautifully snowing in Detroit, and they're together in a hotel room where they're safe from the outside cold. And so like once I realized that was the last one, I was like, oh, okay, I get it. They caught up to where they each wanted to be. All these frozen moments led to this one frozen moment, and now life just continues on, and they have to learn that they can't really be in that hotel room forever, you know. So that last frozen moment will stick with them through the rest of their lives, presumably. But yeah, it's great that it sort of stops there, which is something I will say I never noticed until viewing it for this time. I really enjoyed it.
Right. Yeah, that's kind of the moment they wish they could hold on to. But as we've said, these very important character questions, not necessarily a fictional character, but just a character of who you truly are deep down. these questions are going to come up and stop something that you'd rather have, it's Glenn's thing. It's you would rather not know these things, or you'd rather not be forced to make a decision like this or face up to the fact that this person that you can have a great movie conversation with is kind of antithetical to so many of the things that you value so deeply.
Yeah, absolutely. So I have some quick hitter points that I just feel that need to be brought up, because I'll hate myself if we don't bring them up. And then a couple other things about Soderbergh, but,
MacGuffin diamonds,
MacGuffin diamonds. Great. Love it. The cold blue, cold blue diamonds.
Keep cinematic cool. Basketball.
Cinematic basketball. I enjoyed, again, on the commentary track, Steven Soderbergh said that those days were really hard for Clooney because he's good at basketball. Like it's a known, at least at this time, he's probably too old to be good, but the jump shot never really leaves. But the, apparently the hardest thing for George Clooney to do in this movie was to, swallow his pride and play poorly at basketball. And I will say the basketball, it looks like real people playing basketball that have played basketball before in their life. So
I thought so too.
Yeah, it gets the pass for me. And also, even if that wasn't the case, there aren't a lot of wide shots of the basketball, so you never get the whole body dribble, which is the real Edward Norton in American History X situation, which makes it a real problem even before he does the dunk that's basically the end of the true Hollywood stories of Prince, or the real Hollywood stories from Chappelle's Show.
I'm less of a fan of this movie than you, and I'm less of a fan of Clooney in this movie than you are. So... And I'd seen this movie more than once, but it had been a long time since I had seen it. And I was just waiting for him to do some, like, super sly basketball move. Like, not even just, like, an awesome crossover, but, like, where he hides the ball in his shirt behind his back. Like, just something that just shows how he outsmarted everybody on the court, and that's how he wins at basketball. And they didn't do it at all. So I was quite relieved.
Yeah, that is true. And that's something I have always appreciated about Clooney. It's something that's very evident in this movie that we have talked about, and that for somebody whose image is always like the charming, suave man, that he is so willing to play dumb pretty frequently is it just always makes me happy, so that it, I'm glad that he swallowed his pride and didn't do some some slide call the elevator play and then drain a dope Jay. Reading is fundamental and shit, and we all just got excited. Might be one of my favorite moments in cinematic history in the library. I just have to mention it.
It's quite wonderful.
You like Schubert? Well, I don't. Later, when Isaiah yep. Washington's character, whose name I can't forget or can't remember, is talking to Midge, the beer throw that gets missed and goes in the pool, obviously fantastic.
Yep.
Don Cheadle sliding down the stairs at the end of the movie, combined with how he performs his death, fantastic. Like, one, that's clearly Don Cheadle doing that scene. That looks yeah. incredibly painful. Yeah. And two, the way he plays his death is just great. And it feels like, it doesn't feel like a movie death where somebody gets shot in the arm and they're like, oh, now I'm dead. I lie on the ground slowly. You know, it feels like I have never seen somebody get shot to death. I hope to never have to see it. But it just feels more accurate to what your body would do. It would shut down, you know?
Yeah.
And I really enjoy that. I just think that the body control there is very impressive. Yeah. And finally, like, I mean, this is the first time Steven Soderbergh and George Clooney worked together. They ended up forming Section 8 together, which was a production company that lasted throughout the 2000s. And the Ocean's trilogy was basically the cash cow for that. So they set up this production company under Warner Brothers, where they the list of movies they helped to usher into existence is so, like, heartwarming. It's just wonderful when I see people using their fame and taste in good movies, making more good movies. And, you know, and Steven Soderbergh has a big hand in so many good directors who I love having their careers sort of protected, like Todd Haynes, Christopher Nolan. I mean, he somehow got Syriana produced for Steven Gagan, which is, it's still crazy to me that that movie got made. And Michael Clayton, another one of my favorites. Like, you just look at this list of movies that they were able to bring together. And they were able to bring it together, one, because they're friends and clearly seem like similar types of people. They both are very simultaneously very serious about what they do and take nothing seriously ever, which I think perfectly describes this movie. But they went to Warner Brothers and said, you know, we're going to create this production company. We're going to do it on our own. We're going to keep things at a certain level, and you're going to have a very low overhead because we don't care about making money. All they cared about was making movies. And it sucks that kind of ran out when the Ocean's trilogy did, but that they had, you know, 7 to 10 years of it is amazing.
Yeah.
So I wanted to talk a little bit about Soderbergh just as an auteur, because you said in an email that he's not, and it is a messier line for sure. What was the podcast where we talked about him as an auteur? Was it Traffic or Sex, Lies, and Videotape? Do you remember?
Three Kings?
He didn't do Three Kings.
I know that, but I felt like that came up for some reason. No. I don't know.
Because I yeah. like when you said that in email, I was like, yep, that sounds like something I definitely would have said at some point, but it's yeah. also not something I believe today. Yeah.
Yeah, and we may have landed on the fact that it's not a visual style so much, and because he loves doing so many different kinds of movies, it's hard to pin him down as an auteur.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's where we landed on that.
Yeah, and I think that's correct. And I've sort of, over the past few months, I've sort of started to realize that, I mean, I mentioned it in this earlier in this podcast, like, the way that I sort of look at Steven Soderbergh as an auteur is that he takes things that anybody, like a director could make, and does it in a way that that nobody else can quite do, you know? Like, and it's also something that's very difficult to describe, you know? You say Side Effects, which is another movie we've talked about on this podcast many years ago. It's a movie about prescription drugs and the problems of prescription drugs that is made like a horror movie and is made in this very creative way that I can't imagine anybody else making. I can imagine somebody making a horror movie about prescription drugs, but not in the way that movie was made, that specific movie was made. Just like this movie so frequently feels like the one of the many many cousins of Pulp Fiction that were made in the 1990s when Pulp Fiction made over $100 million. So everybody's like, let's get our crime film made by that young up-and-coming director. And Soderbergh doesn't quite fit the young up-and-coming director because he had already done Sex, Lies, and Videotape. But he was certainly, like, he fit the bill in that he was the stylish guy willing to try some shit who loved the French New Wave, you know? And I just sort of look at all of his movies and they always feel like he's like the auteur of contrarianism. And I think that that really speaks to why. You. Yeah, me for sure. And why that I have liked him for so long with, you know, without even necessarily being able to explain why sometimes, you know, like he makes movies the way that you're quote unquote not supposed to. This is by stylistic on a stylistic level. This movie is very restrained for Steven Soderbergh. I think that was part of his design, but even within that, it still does a lot of things that you're quote unquote not supposed to do. You know, just the opening shot of this movie, you get it's out of focus, people walking out of focus. We get a quick rack focus into the Miami skyline. Then we're getting zooms and pans at the same time. We find Clooney. We get the freeze frame as he's throwing his tie. There had already been two freeze frames by that point. And then we cut in closer to Clooney and does the tie throw again. Like it's like a weird jump cut, but it jumps backwards. And this is the first 50 seconds of the movie. Like it's crazy. And, you know, throughout the movie, there are a couple of zooms that are clearly accidental that he just keeps in because I think he understands that so many filmmakers try to make their movie, like Fincher's the perfect example of this. He tries to make his movies like the eye of God is the only perspective you have, right? Where everything is perfect, whereas Soderbergh knows he's sort of like a deconstructionist. He knows that everybody knows that there are people making these movies, so human error has to be in these movies. Clooney hits a painting later when he's right before he's about to shoot Isaiah Washington and then like steadies it very quickly, you know, and I bet that's the only take that happened on, so it was obviously the one that went in there, you know. And he's just Soderbergh's very honest about the machinations of filmmaking, you know. And one of my favorite moments in this commentary track is right before the prison escape at the beginning. He's doing the commentary track with Scott Frank, the screenwriter. Scott Frank says, "I always wondered why there was a vase of flowers in the prison chapel." Steven Soderbergh immediately says, "Well, the prop guy put it there." Like it's just, and like that's it. And he just moves on, totally deadpan. It's just like this is the obvious truth, you know. Yeah. And the thing that's so good to me, like it, you can look at the way that this movie portrays any sort of 9-to-5 or institution, like even the FBI surveillance, like in Miami, which is played to great laughs. But it's just the stupidity of people doing the same thing every day. The ad guys in the bar fit in the 9-to-5 mold. Jack literally throwing a tie. It could not be in anger and then immediately going to rob a bank. You know, these things. It's just sort of like there's just no way he's willing to accept what other people do, you know? Yeah. And I love that. And when we talked about these movies at the time, they were typically hyper-violent. You know, a lot of the cousins of Pulp Fiction were more like the Boondock Saints, where it's just like, let's just show people get murdered. And then we'll yell out Bible verses, because that's what Samuel L. Jackson did in Pulp Fiction. And it was awesome in Pulp Fiction. It wasn't awesome in any other movie that tried it, you know? And even Jack being the thief that doesn't use guns, you know? Like, that also is in direct contrast to these movies. You know, and just the in Karen and Jack is kind of like, he's the more stereotypically female character type, you know. He's the more emotional one, he's the more romantic one. He's the one that goes shopping in this movie to buy clothes to impress the character. And Karen's this more
has a bath.
Yeah. Oh, I love that if that fantasy was from Jack's perspective, it would be so weird. And like the whole movie wouldn't work if that was from Jack's perspective, but since it's from Karen's perspective, that makes it so much better. And it makes the movie work. I think that's a really small thing a thing they always forget about. I'm always like ready to roll my eyes and then Karen wakes up and I'm like, holy shit, good choice, you know? But yeah, all the other types of stuff. And, you know, late in the movie when Jack says to Buddy, do you know anybody who has done one last big score and gone on to live the good life? Like, Jack is explicitly questioning the type of movie he's in, and the end of the movie couldn't be better for that type of thing, you know, because it wraps up everything we've had before. It shows us that time is a flat circle, and that lighters can be had in the back of vans but not in jail. But they're like, it's our two main characters riding off into the you know, into the distance together, but they're also not riding off into the sunset, right? It's the morning. Yeah. They're running off into the sunrise, you know? And it's not where they really want to be, but they are still running off to this hopeful this hopeful thing together, despite the fact that there is a literal cage in between them. But they're riding off into this hopeful new day, riding off together, and they're riding off at the exact opposite time of day that that most movies have sort of conditioned us to think, you know. Yeah. And I think that's Steven Soderbergh in a nutshell. And for a movie that is I think he felt was more of an assignment film than a lot of the films he has made since then, it's pretty impressive how much he can subtly get in to this movie that is very very stylistically Soderberghian. Yeah,
I will agree. Well said.
I hope. It was long. So.
I know. But it was good.
So thank you for listening to the MacGuffin Men. Be sure to check back next week when we talk about all the things from Out of Sight that I forgot to mention.